Exodus chapter 16. The whole Israelite community set out from Elim and came to the desert of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had come out of Egypt. In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat round pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you've brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death." Then the Lord said to Moses, "I will rain down bread from heaven for you. The people are to go out each day and gather enough for that day. And this way I will test them and see whether they will follow my instructions. On the sixth day, they are to prepare what they bring in, and that is to be twice as much as they gather on the other days." So Moses and Aaron said, "It was the Lord who brought you out of Egypt. And in the morning you will see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your grumbling against him. Who are we that you should grumble against us?" Moses also said, "You will know that it was the evening and all the bread you want in the morning, because he has heard your grumbling against him. Who are we that you are grumbling against us, but against the Lord?" Then Moses told Aaron, "Say to the entire Israelite community, come before the Lord, for he has heard your grumbling." While Aaron was speaking to the whole Israelite community, they looked toward the desert, and there was the glory of the Lord appearing in the cloud. The Lord said to Moses, "I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Tell them, at twilight you will eat meat, and in the morning you will be filled with bread. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God." That evening, quail came covering the camp, and in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the dew was gone, thin flakes like frost on the ground appeared on the desert floor. When the Israelites saw it, they said to each other, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. Moses said to them, "It is the bread the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Each one is to gather as much as he needs. Take an omer for each person that you have in your tent." The Israelites did as they were told. Some gathered much, some little. And when they measured it by the omer, he who gathered much did not have too much, and he who had gathered little did not have too little. Each one gathered as much as he needed. Then Moses said to them, "No one is to keep any of it until morning." However, some of them paid no attention to Moses, full of maggots, and began to smell. So Moses was angry with them. Each morning, everyone gathered as much as he needed, and when the sun grew hot, it melted away. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much, two omers for each person. And the leaders of the community came and reported this to Moses. He said to them, "This is what the Lord commanded. Tomorrow is to be a day of rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. So bake what you want to bake and boil what you want to boil. Save whatever is left and keep it until morning." So they saved it until morning as Moses commanded, and it didn't stink or get maggots in it. "Eat it today," Moses said, "because today is a Sabbath to the Lord. You will not find any of it on the ground today. 6 days you are to gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will not be any. Nevertheless, some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather it, but they found none. Then the Lord said to Moses, "How long will you refuse to keep my commands and my instructions? Bear in mind that the Lord has given you the Sabbath. That is why on the sixth day, he gives you bread for 2 days. Everyone is to stay where he is on the seventh day. No one is to go out." So the people rested on the seventh day. The people of Israel called the bread manna. It was white like coriander seed and tasted like wafers made with honey. Moses said, "This is what the Lord has commanded. Take an omer of manna and keep it for the generations to come, so they can see the bread I gave you to eat in the desert when I brought you out of Egypt." So Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omer of manna in it. Then place it before the Lord to be kept for the generations to come. As the Lord commanded Moses, Aaron put the manna in front of the testimony that it might be kept. The Israelites ate manna for 40 years until they came to the land that was settled. They ate manna until they reached the border of Canaan. Amen.
I like this story. I hope you enjoy this story. Now, I've got a question for you as we get started, just in case you were getting too dopey. That's the problem with the clocks changing, I think, is that suddenly by this point in the evening, it begins to feel quite late, especially if you made the mistake of getting up the wrong time this morning. So this is my question. Are you a panicker or a denier? So something is happening. Are you the sort of person who worries? You know, you fret all night, you stay up. You know, so for instance, you're getting an aeroplane tomorrow. What do you do? Did you pack 3 weeks ago and it's all been laid out on the spare bed and no one's been allowed to go anywhere near it? Steve's looking at you. Are you the sort of person who likes to have everything all organized, you know, and so nothing go wrong? I mean, I'm like this. If I'm in the queue at the airport, I'm checking my wallet, my phone, I'm checking my passport, I'm checking every liquid isn't over 100, I'm rechecking everything. Or are you a denier? Are you the sort of person that something's coming, like, oh, it'll be fine again. And then it gets to the morning, you think, oh, sorry, I just get up half an hour earlier and pack a bag. And you're like, Where's my bag? Because you know, it wasn't where you'd left it 5 years ago. Surprise, surprise. Are you a panicker or a denier? Are you the sort of person who overthinks and worries about everything? Or do you just kind of, you're so laid back that you're nearly horizontal? I got the language from a news article I read recently about the Church of England and what's the future of the Church of England. The numbers are plummeting, what's going to happen? And in the Church of England, apparently, there are two different groups. There's the panickers, who will just do anything to try and turn things around. And the dieters say, look, if we just keep doing the right thing, it'll all be okay. And I thought actually it was a very helpful way of separating those two groups of people. Well, if you're just joining us, then you're joining us about halfway through the book and actually getting on towards the end of our series. And the question I want us to be thinking about today is this. Can I really trust God? If you're a Christian for a long time, I would imagine it's still a question that you have asked along the way. Times when you look at an impending problem, you think, can I really trust God? And if you're a panicker, then your lack of trust, your lack of faith, your doubt will lead to enormous energy. If you're a denier, then that lack of faith, that doubt, will lead you to put your head in the sand. If you're not a Christian, you're here, and you're sort of looking in the shop window of the Christian faith and wondering what it's all about. I wouldn't be surprised if this sort of question is in your mind too. Can I really trust this God? Is there really a God here who's worth trusting? You know, most of the people who pop into church, who come along to visit services, most of them believe in some sort of God, some sort of spiritual realm, something that's going on. But in my experience, most of the people I meet, they believe that God, who, you know, is some sort of big elemental force, made the world once upon a time, and now he's distant. If he's a person at all, he's really not that interested in us. Can I really trust this God? In fact, it's a very obvious question, I think, to ask if you're thinking about becoming a Christian. And so next week at our confirmation service, there'll be people getting up the front, declaring to everybody, I believe in this God, and I will commit myself to walk with this God, to obey this God, to live for this God. In fact, on Tuesday this week, a last chance now to join, we have Christianity Explored beginning. It's a great opportunity. You can bring along a friend, come yourself, to look at the questions of life, to examine the Christian faith, right back before somebody who's been a Christian for a while. Because it can be so good to go back and remind ourselves the absolute fundamentals of what Christians believe. And sometimes coming onto church can feel a bit like jumping in halfway through a book, or walking in to the kind of, while you know, your family's watching some detective show, and you walk in and they're going, well, I don't know who he is. Is he the baddie or the goodie? And is that the detective? And it can feel a bit like that, all these words that we use in church. And so we've got Christianity Explored coming up as an opportunity for us to think through those kind of questions. But the question I would hope that we would answer in that course is this. Can I really trust God? It was just this week, I went to go and see a lady in our congregation, and this would be a relatively normal conversation. I have this every so often, every few months, with somebody who's been a Christian for many years. They've known God's faithfulness, they've got a real, true faith in God. And yet, as things get difficult, as we face particular struggles, particular challenges, we begin to wonder, can I really trust God with this? So 6 months ago, there was a lady who was coming towards the end of her life. She'd walked with God for over 70 years, and she's now saying, can I really trust this God? Is what I've been walking, the life and faith I've been walking my life, is it really true? Or lady just this week, been spending years fighting off cancer, doing so well, thinks she's going to the doctor to be told that she's clear, and they found that it's progressed. It's developed secondary cancer elsewhere, and she's got weeks to live. And completely naturally, her faith is shaken. But I thought God was with me. I thought he was helping me over this. And I've got weeks to live. Can I really trust God? When I face up to the actual reality of death, not some hypothetical thing that will happen one day, when I am aware of the fact that I'm likely to be in a grave in the next 3 months, can I really trust God? It's a very normal question. And it's a character's going through. Can I trust this God? Will he really? Yes, we saw it with Abraham when we were looking back at the beginning of the Bible. We find it with Adam and Eve. Can we really trust this God? Has he really given us good instructions? You find it even with Jesus. Even Jesus' prayer the night before he dies is there some other way? Is there some other way? No, I will trust you. Your will, not mine. Let's slightly recap the story of Exodus. So the people of Israel, they move to Egypt, and they're in Egypt, and as they begin to grow, the king, the Pharaoh, begins to get worried about this people group growing, and so squashes them, as rulers often do to minorities, squashes them and oppresses them and makes them slaves. They become a slave nation, and the more they are oppressed, the more they spread, and they call out to their God, Yahweh. They call out to their God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, save us. And God raises up Moses. He saves him as a baby. He's brought up first by his mother, then he's brought up in the palace with Pharaoh, under the care of Pharaoh's daughter. But as he grows up, he sees a battle, he sees a fight going on, an Israelite being oppressed by an Egyptian, and he gets involved, and he kills the Egyptian, and when it's found out, he flees. He runs. He runs as far away as he can. He runs to Midian, where he becomes a shepherd, and then he's on the far side of the wilderness when he sees a bush that is on fire and yet not burning up. And he goes to it, and from that bush, God speaks to him. And God says this, go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you. And this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. He's on Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb, the mountain of God. It says, I'm going to rescue my people, and I'm going to bring you all back here. So Moses goes back, and through mighty power, God judges the Egyptians and frees the Israelites. And when Pharaoh finally relents and lets them go, they begin to flee, but then he changes his mind. And as the Israelites kind of going over the horizon, up gets Pharaoh with his army on horseback, and they pursue them, and they pursue them to the edge of the sea. And we have God's people trapped between the Red Sea and this oncoming army, and God parts the water and leads them through on dry ground. And as the Egyptian horsemen go across the sea through this dry path to try and catch the Israelites, God sends the sea back across, and they are washed away. They are free. And they find themselves finally free, with a big bit of water between themselves and Egypt, with no army left to chase them. They are free, they are saved, and they are on the way to the mountain and on the way to the promised land. And what do? Well, the first thing they do actually is they sing a wonderful song. Miriam leads them in singing a song, and I will sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. both horse and driver. He's hurled into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my defense. He has become my salvation. He is my God and I will praise him. My father's God and I will exalt him. They look and they see the destruction of their enemies and they praise God. But by now, if you can see the screen, let me just talk you through what's going on. Top left, over you've got Ramesses and the main city, which is where they began. And this arrow is the approximate route of the Exodus. So Egypt, they escape through Egypt, they cross the sea, and they come down, one, two, three, three is where they cross the sea, and then they end up in the wilderness. And they're there in the wilderness, they sing their song of praise, and then they look around them and they realize that there's no water. They're in a desert. There's a sea behind them. That's not a lot of use. And they grumble. God has just saved them amazingly, wonderfully. They are free from slavery and they look around and they're thirsty. And they get to a place called Marah, which means bitter, because they taste the water and it's bitter. And they go, we can't drink this. We're so thirsty. We can't drink this. And God gives them a bit of wood, a bush to throw in the water that makes it sweet. And he provides water for them. And they go, okay, maybe God can provide for us. He then takes them actually to a place called Elim, where there were 12 springs. And that's one for each of the 12 tribes of Israel. They've got enough. There's plenty of water. And then on they go. If you just look at this a quarter, maybe as much as a third of the way through the journey, time-wise, there are a few weeks into a journey that is eventually going to take more than 40 years. But even distance-wise, they're a fraction of the way there. And as soon as their thirst is quenched and they get on their way, they realize they're hungry. You know, maybe they left with a few supplies. They've got through them, and they immediately start to grumble again. Water out of nowhere. And they now begin to grumble. We're hungry. The Israelites said to him, verse 3, if only we died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. I think they might be rose-tinted a little. They were in harsh slavery. And they turned to Moses and Aaron and said, you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death. What should God do to this idiotic, ungrateful people? People who have forgotten what he has just done. Water out of nowhere. I think he might be able to manage the food thing too. But they don't turn to pray, they turn to grumble. How often can we do that? How often are we quicker to grumble than we are to pray? God is right there, listening. He's got all the resources that you need, and yet we moan and grumble. So God says this, I will rain down bread from heaven for you. The people have to go out each day and gather enough for that day. In this way, I will test them to see whether they will follow my instructions. See, the question is, can they really trust God? All the way along, they're saying, well, okay, he saved us, he's brought us out of Egypt, but here comes this army to catch us. Oh, wow, the Lord can save us and get us through the Red Sea and destroy the enemies. Wow. Oh, we're thirsty. Can we really trust God for water? He gives us water. They turn around, they're hungry. We're hungry, this is terrible. Can we trust God to feed us? And God turns on his head. He says, I'm going to feed them. I'm going to rain down bread. But he says this, in this way, I will test them and see whether they will follow my instructions. Now, when was the last time you had a test that you enjoyed? It was, oh, I had a blood test last week. It was a delight. Next time I'll take the family. Tests are not welcome things. If someone says, oh, you've got a test, you're not looking forward to it. But tests are not always quite as bad as we feel. You see, the problem with a test, we normally think a test is about finding us wanting. It finds our lack. So you go in, you go into a test, and it reveals how ignorant and stupid you are. Or you go and have a test and it finds some terrible disease that you don't want. That's not always how tests work. Think of a driving test. Most people don't look forward to their driving test. I remember mine. It was booked for Thursday. And on the Saturday, I was up in the northeast. On the Saturday, I was supposed to drive from the northeast to Kent. There was realistically no real way that I could do it in between the end of work on Friday and still be there for the wedding. I had to drive. So I had the test on Thursday. And I was excited about the test. I was a bit nervous. I go to the test. And at the end of the test, he says, right, well, I'm pleased to tell you you've passed. Yes! I go to the wedding. You're free to drive. Here's your license. Off you go. Tests aren't always bad. Because tests aren't always about finding you wanting. Sometimes they're actually proving that you do have what it takes. You do know what you need to know. You can do it. Think about any sports match of any sort, any fixture of any sort. Isn't that a test? Isn't it a sort of battle of who's better? Or you think of any athlete kind of running a time trial, anyone doing kind of, you know, you're working towards your triathlon, and you do the time trial, you practice your swimming, you're saying, I've got to do this distance, under this time, and you keep doing it, and you keep pushing yourselves, and every time you manage it, every time you meet the test, you get stronger. Every time, even you fail the test, even through the failed test, you get stronger. It's to see if they can, and to build their muscles. And so when God says here, I'm going to test them, he's not saying, like some heavenly examiner, right, I've got a 52-point quiz, and if you don't get 52 right, then you're out. In fact, I did a test recently, and the pass mark was 100%. That is immensely stressful, because even the questions you think are really obvious, you don't want to risk. But it's not like God is sort of sitting there as some kind of traffic warden going, oh, there must be something wrong. Let's find out what's wrong. Now, God is saying, I'm going to test them because he wants to train. He wants to train them. He wants to teach them. He wants to draw them on. I'm going to push them harder. I'm going to teach them and train them in faith. I'm going to build their faith muscles. Because actually what he doesn't say, I'm not going to feed them and I'm going to see how long they survive. Or I'm going to wait until they say the magic word. Now, what he says, I'm going to rain down bread from heaven. I'm going to send down bread on them. Can we trust this God? Well, God says, can you trust me? Because God is reliable. In the deal of we trust God and he provides for us, the problem isn't in his provision, it's in our faith. It's that our faith is so weak, so temperamental. My feeling of my spiritual warmth and my excitement about following God can depend on whether or not I had time for breakfast this morning. But it's never the case like that with God. He's faithful. And he provides. And he even provides for grumbling, ungrateful Israelites in the desert. They're right there. They're on their way to Mount Sinai. Remember what God said to Moses? He said, this will be a sign to you. You're going to go and get them, and you're going to bring them back to this mountain. They've been at Marah. They've been at Elim. They're now wandering in the wilderness. They've got to get to Sinai. That's where they're going. God has said he's going to do it. Are you going to trust him? Or are you going to let him down? But he will do it. Who are you kidding if you think you can really test God? Can you trust this God? Well, I tell you, he is trustworthy. You see, what they faced was a normal problem on an epic scale. There's about 1.5 million, some people estimate up to 2 million Israelites. They've left behind all the glories and wealth and comfort that in theory they seem to think they had when they were back in slavery in Egypt. They've come with gold and with food and everything. They've come across the sea. They're now in the middle of nowhere. There's no food. 1.5 million people to feed. I mean, that's an astonishing amount of food. I can't even imagine how much food. I mean, I get a bit stressed when we're getting more than sort of 6 people to lunch. And here we go, you know, we're catering for 80 for a church event. You think, 1.5 million people. It's a normal problem. There's not enough food. I mean, there are people today all over the world without enough food. We're watching the news just the other day about the civil war in Yemen and how there are about 8 or 9 million people who do not have access to healthcare and need it badly. These are the kind of problems that go on. They're on an epic scale. Can God do it? Can he prove trustworthy? Well, he says, I will rain down bread from heaven for you. In this way, I will test them and see whether they can follow my instructions. On the sixth day, they're to prepare what they bring in, and that is twice as much as they gather on the other days. So Moses says, you know, stop your grumbling. God's heard it. There's no point grumbling at us. It wasn't us who brought you here anyway. It was God. So wait on the Lord. Come before the Lord, verse 9, for he has heard your grumbling. While Aaron was speaking to the whole Israelite community, they looked towards the desert, and there was the glory of the Lord appearing in the cloud. The Lord said to Moses, I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. That evening, quail come, and they land all around the camp. I talk about fast food. That's brilliant, isn't it? I mean, all these birds just come and land just near the camp. That's brilliant. It just appears. They're in the desert. Where did the quail come from? Why are the quail in the desert? But they appear. There they are. They just arrive. And then in the morning, there's dew everywhere. And as they sort of cutting out, rubbing the sleep out of their eyes, and the dew evaporates in the desert, as it will do pretty soon, left on the ground are these white flakes, a bit like coriander seed. And they pick it up going, what's this? What's this? What's this? And 3,500 years later, we're still calling it, what's this? This thingamajig-bob, manna, which means, what is it? And everyone's going around going, what is it? And I go, what is it? And again, everyone's, what is it? And I go, what is it? What is it? What is it? All right. What is it? Let's call it that. And they get this, what is it? And they take it back. And it tastes like wafers sweetened with honey in the desert. I've been to Mount Sinai. Not a lot grows there. You know, you can find the occasional kind of cactus-y type scrub plant in a dell where there's a bit of moisture. But nothing grows there. And yet enough food has just appeared on the ground for 1.5 million people. And we doubt him. Why did they doubt him? They'd seen him rescue them from the Egyptian horsemen. They'd seen him just provide 12 springs for 12 tribes. And now he just... this food just lands, the birds just come, sort of, eat me, eat me, eat me, tweet, tweet, eat me. And then in the morning, there's some sort of grainy bread stuff on the floor. They go, what is it? What's this? And they gather it. I love this graphic I managed to find online. Cloudy with a chance of quail and manna. That's what happens here. This food rains, probably not in loads of bread. I'm not sure that was quite the idea. But it just appears. It's miraculous. It's astonishing. And that is what God does. Let's look a little bit more, just at a few details of how this works. So it comes daily. That's what happens. So it says here, I've heard the grumbling, verse 12, of the Israelites. Tell them, at twilight you'll eat meat, and in the morning you'll be filled with bread. Then you will know that I am the Lord, your God. Yahweh, I am your God. That evening the quail came. In the morning the bread came. And they go, what is it? And Moses says, it is the bread the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Remember, God provides and he commands. And he says this, everyone is to gather as much as they need, take an omer, that's about 1.5 kilograms, take an omer for each person that you have in your tent. So you're in a tent of 5 people, go and get 5 omer and take them back for your family. Go and eat that. So they did it. Some gathered much, some gathered little. Everyone gathered just as much as they needed. And Moses said to them, verse 19, no one is to keep any of it until morning. You see, this food came daily, meat in the evening, bread in the morning. And they told us, go take it, eat it, enjoy it. But don't keep it. It comes daily, and they have to take what they need today and not for tomorrow. But why? Well, you need it today, so take it today. But why would you take it for tomorrow? Surely your reason for stocking up, it's the same reason that, you know, that crazy Americans kind of buy loads and loads of tin cans and put them in their weird concrete basement for when the apocalypse comes or something. It's because they think the supply is going to dry up. So why would you take more manna or quail than you need? Because you don't think the supply is reliable. You think there's a chance that when you go out of your tent in the morning, there won't be any manna left. You don't trust the source. That's why when there's even a whiff of a petrol shortage, people line up outside the petrol stations to fill their cars up. They go with their little plastic cans, get as much fuel as you can. Why? Because the source is going to dry up. And remember, God has said, I'm going to test them. He's going to train them to trust. So they have to take for today what they need for today. Some of them don't. Verse 20, some of them paid no attention to Moses. They kept part of it until the morning, but it was full of maggots and began to smell. And Moses was very angry with them. If you've been camping, particularly, I remember we used to go camping in France. And we didn't have any of these electric fridges or anything. You know, we had a cool box, which is basically a plastic box with some melted ice in it, yeah? And my dad loved smelly cheese. And everybody knew when you'd gone just to get some milk out or something, because the whiff of the smelly cheese would just fill the entire tent. Well, imagine this. People are holding on to manna, and it stinks. And Moses is angry. He's saying, what are you doing? So each morning, everyone gathered as much as they needed, and when the sun grew hot, it just melted away. Get what you need for today, and not for tomorrow. You see, when Jesus teaches us to pray, he says, give us each day our daily bread. Give me what I need for today. And you know what? Most of the time, so much of our energy is expended trying to get more than we need, trying to store it up, building up the pension plan, paying off the mortgage, getting the savings account, just so we've got a bit of a buffer in case the supply runs out. And we're taught to pray, give us today our daily bread. But there is a day that they are supposed to gather twice as much. So first day, second day, third day, fourth day, fifth day, one day only. The sixth day, collect double, because you're not going to be collecting any on the Sabbath. Why? Because the Sabbath is a day holy to God. God is teaching them and training them. He's saying, the problem is, and we know this so much, don't we? If you work, and this is particularly you if you're a panicker, you will see a problem and you will think, if I only plan better or work harder, if I put more hours in, then I will be more secure. I'll be more safe. You know, if you're that kind of person, which as soon as somebody comes up with a problem, or as soon as you notice a problem, you're thinking, right, I can do something about that. And rest is about saying, you know what? I trust in God. So on that sixth day, they would take twice as much, and they were to hold on to it, and it wouldn't go moldy. I mean, tell me that's not miraculous. It wouldn't go moldy. But nevertheless, some people, they just keep collecting one day's lot. So they go out on the seventh day, and they're looking around, and there's nothing there. And God's provision comes with his command. And they're not paying any attention. They're just after the stuff. They're not interested in the relationship. They're not interested in God and what he says. They think they need to collect in order to have. And the Lord says through Moses, how long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my instructions? Bear in mind that the Lord has given you the Sabbath. That's why on the sixth day, he gives you bread for 2 days. Everyone is to stay where they are on the seventh day. No one's to go out. Resting on the Sabbath. And this daily provision went on for 40 years. Did you notice that? Verse 35. The Israelites ate manna for 40 years. Imagine you would have got a bit sick of it every so often. But they're in the middle of nowhere. And a cargo don't deliver, but God does. Along comes the quail every evening and the manna every morning with a double portion to prepare for the Sabbath for 40 years. And they're told, remember this. And so they collect an omer and they put it in the ark and they take it with them, placed before the Lord. So the people come and go, how did my ancestors survive again? Oh yeah, Look in that jar. Can you see that weird white flaky stuff? That. God provided. 40 years he provided for them. This is what God's provision looks like. And I think a lot of the time what we want is we want our solution right now, and we always want more than we need, don't we? We're never quite satisfied. We're swept along by our culture that is always saying more, more, more. Upgrade this. That's out of date. You want more. One of the things that's very interesting, every harvest in the food bank, is how many out-of-date products we get given. Why? Because everyone's stockpiled at home. And it gets to harvest, and somebody goes, I can finally get rid of those kidney beans. And they reach the back of the cupboard, and they come and give us stuff that we then have to throw away for them. Because everyone's kind of stockpiled. We've all got more than we need. You look around yourself. Look in your wardrobe. How many outfits do you have? Look, how many shoes have you got? We've got so much more than we need. And every time we take more than we need, it reveals that we aren't trusting. We aren't trusting that what God has given us is enough for us. That God is the provider and he walks with his people. He can feed them in a desert. See, remember, what they faced was they faced hunger, and people face that today all over the place. And you might well have gone through times yourself where things are just exceptionally difficult. I remember we had a time, it's just a few years ago actually, where for some reason, we got to the point about 3 weeks through the month where all the money had gone. I mean, I don't know why. I hadn't gone to Vegas or anything. It wasn't like I'd blown it all. I hadn't, honest. But we didn't get to the point. I was going to look in the bank and go, I don't know where all the money's gone. We've got sort of 30, 35 quid left. And thinking, we've got a week or so to go. What's going to happen? And we began to add it up. And the next in envelope comes through our letterbox of 70 quid. And it gets us to the end of the month. Frankly, I'd have loved a couple of hundred. But, you know, but God gives us what we need. There's another time I was working for a church up in the Northeast, and I was doing what is sometimes called living by faith. So you basically just live and trust that God's going to give you the money that you need. And it seemed to work. And there was one point I was actually feeling reasonably flush. I just passed my driving test, which might explain something a little bit later in the story. But I was feeling quite flush. I had someone amazing. I had money. I mean, it was amazing. And then somebody gave me a check for £1,000. I was like, what do I do with this? I don't need this. And I remember I had it on my desk. I was like, should I give it back? Should I accept it and store it? What should I do with this? And the next day, I was in a fender bender, in just a minor car accident with a taxi. And, you know, if you get in a minor fender bender, you don't want to go anywhere near insurance companies. And it was all my fault. He was a tough northeastern taxi driver, so I wasn't going to mess with him. And it was entirely my fault, and I'd passed my test about 2 months earlier. So I didn't want anything on my insurance. So, you know, we dealt with it, and I got the cars fixed. And it cost £990. So, you know, I went down the pub with my friend and spent the rest of the money. And, you know, God knows what he's doing, doesn't he? He gave me just what I needed, but that time he gave me a day before I needed it. And I'm sure in this room, people have all sorts of stories about how God needed it. You see, the Israelites here, they faced a normal problem, but on an epic scale. 1.5 million people in the middle of nowhere need food. And God fixed it. God provided what they need. Exactly what they needed at the time, and he did it continually for 40 years. And I tell you what, if God can fix that, then he can look after me. Let's pray together. Lord our God, thank you that you are the faithful God. And Lord, we come to you. Different people, different places in our journey with you. Some of us feeling committed and excited about following you. Others feeling doubtful and struggling. Others just looking on and wondering if you really, Lord, for the example here, are foolish human beings who do not trust you. And yet your faithfulness and generosity in providing continually for them just what they needed. Lord our God, teach us train us, test us, dare we say, that our faith muscles might grow and that you would prove to be a faithful God. Amen.